The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So good morning. So today's topic is going to be willpower. And it's a topic, a theme, which Buddhists in the West often seldom pick up. It's, I think maybe for good reasons, Western Buddhist teachers often just ignore this topic of, or the concept, Western concept of willpower or self-control in favor of other terms, other ideas. But I would like to look a little bit at this issue. And I did some reading around it this last few days and came across, I think, a delightful quote. The quote was, if desiring, if having desires was an Olympic sport, we'd all qualify for the team. So, you know, so desires are a huge part of human life. They've done experiments where they've had people carry with them, around them, little alarms, little buzzers or something that the researchers would periodically, through the day, beep them. And then when they heard the beep, you're supposed to check in with your mind, find out what your mind's doing, and record it. And extremely high percentage of the time, those particular people who did the experiment, were in the experiment, what their mind was doing was having desires for something. So desires are a huge part of life. And learning how to work with our desires, deal with our desires, is a very important part of any human life. And it's a very important part of a Buddhist spiritual life, spiritual practice, is to somehow understand, come to terms with, deal with the fact that we are human desirelings. The desire is such a big part of our life. And many people struggle with desire. Some people have desires, but there's inertia to follow through on them. A lot of people would like to meditate, but to get around to meditating every day is, there's a big challenge and hurdle for some people. The inertia, sometimes it's laziness. Sometimes we have desires for a variety of things that we want to do, and there's fear that inhibits us from following through. And sometimes we have desires for things we want to do, and the world is a better place because we don't act on those desires. Not all of our desires are helpful for others. We can create havoc and tremendous pain in the world by acting too freely on our desires. In fact, it's been argued that the 1 million or so people who are incarcerated in the United States were acting on desires. And, you know, and the issue of self-control has become a huge issue to understand criminality. People who are involved in criminal activities have been studied now and find that one of the factors that they seem to be represent them fairly across the board is a very low capacity for self-control. And chances are that you're not in jail because your capacity for self-control is a little bit higher. And so, anyways, people have desires which we should better not act on. And some of you, I'm sure, you know, can go through a list of your top 10 desires that maybe are a little bit of a challenge for you. It could be as simple as how much time you spend on the internet. You realize, you know, it's not so good to stay in the internet surfing the web late at night. You know, you should go to bed. But, you know, just... And so then, you know, there's a desire to stay on. There's a certain kind of pleasure. In fact, sometimes there's addiction there. It's actually some people have huge problems in their lives because of addiction to the internet. And but even short of addiction, there's issues, you know. And then there's desires for food. You know, I have no shortage of desires for wonderful, tasty foods. If I ate every time I had a desire for food, that would be a problem for me. I'd be sick. But, you know, so, you know, every time we have desire for certain kinds of pleasures, even innocent pleasures, to follow through on all the desires we have is not often so useful. It's not timely. The issue of how to relate to desire, how to act on desires, how not to act on desires, how to make choices on desires, is a huge part of human life. And in Western psychology, sometimes the ability to deal with it sometimes is called self-regulation. And in one of the books I was reading recently, it's called Self-Control. And they also use the word willpower. In fact, the title of the book is called Willpower, a book by Roy Baumeister, a clinical psychologist in Florida. And he reported on a very interesting study. And apparently it was done at Stanford. And the first part of the study, which was meant to be complete in itself, was done, I think, in the early 70s by a man named Walter Meischel. Is that the right name? Pronunciation? Meischel? No one knows. So he did a kind of a very important study, kind of a foundational study for the idea of kind of willpower or self-control, where he took, I guess there's a school at Stanford, elementary school, so I think he used the kids there. And anyway, he took a whole bunch of four-year-old kids, and one at a time he put them in a room, and there was a two-way mirror, I guess, so they were filming them and tracking what the kids did. And the researchers had the kids sit in a chair and said, and then the kid was sitting in the chair with the table right in front, was a plate. On the plate was one marshmallow. And then the kids were given the instruction, you could eat that marshmallow if you'd like. However, I'm going to leave the room and come back in 15 minutes. If you refrain from eating it, when I come back, I'll give you a second marshmallow. You get two. So that's a dilemma. Which, you know, what do you do? Do you eat the marshmallow now and enjoy the pleasure of it? Or do you wait 15 whole minutes to get two, even more pleasure, right? So what would you do? Anyway, so they watch these kids, and it was very interesting to watch the kids. And you could actually, if you go on YouTube and search for marshmallow experiment, you can watch some of these little clips of these kids, and it's quite something to watch these kids deal with this challenge they have. And, you know, you kind of feel for the kids, kind of like torture. You know, they're facial expressions and their various strategies and. You know, some kids try to deal with it by licking it. Or, you know, or playing with it, or trying to just take a little, you know. No one will notice if I take a little piece. Or a variety of things. There was one where there was, I guess, a younger sister and an older brother. And the older brother had more self-control than the younger girl. The girl was maybe, I don't know, two or three. And their communication, what the older brother was trying to tell the sister, but she ate it, hers, before the researcher came back. So they watched and saw the different kids had different strategies. A lot of kids ate the marshmallow. The most common strategy for eating the marshmallow, if they try to hold off, was to distract themselves from the marshmallow. That seemed to be successful. And I read somewhere that one kid got off the chair and got under the table and covered his head for 15 minutes. It successfully avoided the marshmallow. So the idea was that some kids had more self-control. They were able to control themselves rather than just eating the marshmallow. So that was interesting. But coincidentally, this man's daughter went to the same school. And so I guess they spent many years together, and he started noticing, because the reports from his daughter or something, there were differences in the kids in terms of which kids got in trouble, which kids did well in school, and it seemed to be correlated to how well they did in this experiment. And so many years later, he went back and tracked a lot of these kids who did the experiment and tested them for all kinds of personality factors. There's some like dozens of personality factors, qualities of, you know, that that researchers have. And he found that in terms of success in life, avoiding drug problems, happiness, salaries, success in school, a whole bunch of different criteria of when you correlate it with personality factors, all these different things, there was only one that correlated. And that was this early experiment that they had about the kids who had the higher degree of self-control did better in life. So that was the correlation. And so what is it about a self-control, the ability to regulate oneself, to watch what one desires are, and not give in to some, and or to act on the ones you want to act? So this book then is builds on this, and this guy who writes the book has done a lot of experiments over the last, I know, quite a while, up until the last couple of years, on what he calls self-control or self-regulation, or he calls it, that title of the book is Willpower. And he discovers a variety of interesting things about what he calls this ability to choose, or willpower, using your willpower. One thing he found was that they do experiments with people, and if you have people have to use their willpower in a strong way. So, for example, for adults, I think they would have things like put chocolate or chocolate cookies in front of them and say, if you can refrain from eating these cookies for 15 minutes or some time or whatever, then something, I don't know what, but, you know, the idea was to... So they give grown-ups a challenge with a required refrain and self-control, not to come and give in to something. And so people had, you know, all kinds of success, their self-control and avoiding the cookies or something. That was fine. But the real part of the experiment happened next, where they would have them do another kind of experiment that requires capacity for focus, attention, decision-making. And what they found is that when people... the people who had to do the, like, not eat the cookies, or had to do some kind of use willpower to refrain from doing something for some time, then had a harder time using that at the next experiment. But those people who hadn't done the cookie experiment had more willpower in reserve for the second experiment. With the idea being that, and so this guy Baumeister wants to use the analogy or the metaphor of energy, that we have a certain amount of energy for using our brain power, mind power, and if we spend a lot of time making decisions and self-regulating ourselves or using willpower, then we exhaust some of that. And so then they did some experiments with, but they studied, they reported a number of experiments. One was they studied Israeli judges, and who are parole judges in Israel, and when they tended to give the most parole to prisoners and when the least parole to prisoners who came for a parole hearing. And what they found is that the judges would give very few parole to prisoners just before lunch. But after lunch, they gave them like 65% of the people who came up, they would give parole to. And so this idea of having energy for decisions and then to have energy to, you know, it takes energy to make decisions and track things and to regulate oneself. And you can exhaust it. And if you can exhaust it, then it's harder to make wise decisions. I was involved, I think on Thursday, someone asked me to get involved in very, very complicated, for me, discussions about pain choices for our retreat center that's coming up, right? And it was late in the afternoon, and I finally said to the person, I'm tired and hungry. I can't track this. There's too much to track all this and make decisions. Can we do this another time? And then people have studied prisoners, and it seems that prisoners have a high... as I said earlier... self-control seems to be something that people in prisons tend to have very little of. It's partly why they're in prison. But also they found that their glucose levels in their blood tends to be quite low as a kind of, you know, as across the board kind of thing. And they found that if they measure the glucose levels of prisoners, you know, kind of as when they're going to be released, it seems to be a very strong correlation with how soon they're going to be back in prison. So here, this guy used this energy analogy. We need energy to have self-regulate. We need energy to have willpower. And some people who don't process energy, don't have keeping enough, you know, blood sugar up or something, it's harder to make wise decisions. They're more likely to have less self-control and to give in. Is this interesting you a little bit, this review? So then the other, one more interesting thing that this book talks about is that when people's ability to self-regulate, to have willpower, to make, you know, a lot of decisions, have energy for that, dissipates or is low, maybe because it's been used for some time, that there are also people are much more vulnerable to emotional extremes, to swings in their emotions. And so this is an argument for how important it is to not always be on, not always be making decisions, not always be doing things that require self-control, self-regulation, willpower, acting. But it's very important to spend time recovering from that, getting lunch, so that then you can make wiser decisions and or not, be more emotionally stable, have more equilibrium, whatever, through time. So I thought that these were kind of interesting things, and then I tried to reflect on how this relates to Buddhist practice and my experience of practice. I think that a lot of it's maybe underappreciated by how many of us think and talk about Buddhist practice here in the West, of how important self-regulation, willpower, self-control is in practicing. Partly, especially in scenes where mindfulness is overemphasized, like in our scene. when mindfulness is overemphasized, sometimes it's as if just being mindful is enough. Or mindfulness is about just a relaxed acceptance of things. Just to relax and just accept things and everything will be okay. Often de-emphasizing the role of willpower, of choice, of acting and doing, of applying oneself. Because if we apply, a lot of people in the West, if they apply themselves too much, if they make too much effort in practice, they get a headache. They tie themselves in knots. And sometimes there's been, it looks quite ugly in meditation, the people who try too much. But even so, I think a lot of mindfulness practice involves cultivating self-control. So, for example, if you sit down to meditate and you have an itch, the instructions are, don't scratch. That takes self-control. Someone walks into the room and makes a noise, the instinct might be to turn around and see what it is. You're sitting with your eyes closed meditating, and so you let go of that and stay present. You let go of that desire to look and see what that was. If you get more refined in the mind, you're trying to follow the breath, be focused on the breath, and then you have a really nice thought about something. And you decide, I'm not going to follow that thought. I'm going to stay on the breath. I'm going to come back to the breath. That involves self-regulation, involves self-control. Involves what in the West, I think it's fair to say, involves a certain amount of willpower to will oneself, no, I'm not going to be thinking about what's for lunch. I'm going to come back to the present moment and be here. Sitting upright in an upright posture, rather than slouching or just giving up, you know, relaxing too deeply, requires a certain amount of willpower, a certain kind of self-control. And that gets developed. Going on retreat and showing up for every thing on the schedule. The bell rings, you go sit. The bell rings, you go do a walking meditation. Whether you want to or not, you do it. Just you're trying to be mindful and stay present, for sure. But at the same time, a person is strengthening one's capacity for self-control, for willpower, to have some kind of power over the choices you make, but what desires to follow. And I don't think we should underestimate the tremendous value of this kind of training, developing our ability to self-regulate, developing our ability to have willpower, that happens slowly, slowly, bit by bit, in the course of meditation practice. when I look back at my own practice, in the early years of Zen practice, it was very clear that there's a lot, you know, looking. They're really strict about holding a certain posture and not moving for 40 minutes at a time. And there's a lot of self-control, a lot of willpower that's involved, even though the rhetoric sometimes was we're just sitting here and practicing unconditional acceptance of the present moment. So if you listen to the rhetoric, it sounds like, you know, there's no emphasis on self-control, no emphasis on willpower. But in practice, there's a tremendous amount in Zen practice that is there, and that then develops and strengthens slowly over time. And this is what this book called Willpower says, that it doesn't just say you're stuck with the amount of self-control, willpower that you're born with, and tough luck. But he says that you can actually develop it and strengthen it. And it's often strengthened in small things that you do in your life. I haven't finished the book, but I have the impression that one of the small things that he emphasizes is valuable to develop willpower and self-control is attention to your posture. Staying upright and straight makes a big difference, and can, you know, to cultivate that. And that's one of the things also I learned in the Zen monastery. You maintain a certain posture, and that posture, you know, some people will argue it seems like it's, you know, rigid, or it's, you know, there, you know, it's not enough freedom and spontaneity. But in fact, spontaneity is very important. But there's also spontaneity that arises out of or after a foundation of having self-control and self-regulation that happens. And some people say there's actually greater freedom to be found once you've cultivated a strong degree of self-control or self-monitoring, self-regulation that goes on. So then in our Buddhist practice, there are, or look back at the time of the Buddha, his teachings. There's a lot of teachings for the Buddha that fits under the Western category of willpower or self-control. Even the Buddhists don't use that word, maybe for good reason. But it's So, for example, there's something called the five faculties. Usually it's called five faculties in English. In Pali, they're called Indriya. And Indriya refers to the god Indra. And Indra was kind of one of the greatest of the gods in pantheon of ancient India. And so Indra has a lot of power. Indriya is that which belongs to Indra. So we say five faculties or five potentials that we have, but that kind of sidesteps or avoids, maybe because many of us are uncomfortable with this kind of language, that really it means something like lordship. Or some people have translated it as controlling faculties. Those faculties that can control or, involve self-control or ability to monitor, to regulate ourselves, that we need in order to find our way through this, great diversity of desires that come along and be able to track and follow a direction that we want to take. So we have things, the five faculties are faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom or discernment. And faith is a very important quality in terms of deciding what to do and regulating what you do, because it overcomes a lot of doubt, uncertainty, sometimes inability to make commitments. Some people have desires, but they can't commit. Effort overcomes laziness. Overcomes inertia, laziness, effort also is very important. All these, but stands out in my mind as something that's very important for both faith and effort, overcoming fear, our inhibitions, our hesitancy to act because we're afraid and anxious. And then mindfulness is said to overcome heedlessness, doing things that we later regret because we're heedless. We're not really paying attention. We're kind of acting unconsciously. Concentration is said to overcome agitation, but it also overcomes another one of the things that overcomes fear, which is very powerful in people's lives. To develop a relaxed concentration, focus, is a powerful way of dealing with or working through fear or not letting fear get in the way. And then discernment or wisdom tends to overcome ignorance or lack of understanding of what's going on. And better understanding is, the easier it is to act. The better we understand ourselves, the purpose of what we're doing, what the situation is we're in, the easier it is to act if what we want to do is act. So rather than using one word like willpower, here in this list, we can say there's five different aspects of willpower that Buddhism emphasizes. It requires faith, effort, requires mindfulness, concentration, and requires discernment. What's nice about seeing them all together is that you see they work together as a system. And if you only emphasize willpower, part of the problem with that, and this may be one of the reasons, some of the reasons Buddhists in America don't use the word, is that willpower tends to strengthen the idea of self. Kind of sometimes conceit arises out of it, and sometimes it focuses still a bit too much on striving in inappropriate ways. Whereas when you have the whole system of these five, the effort that we make is meant to be balanced with concentration. And concentration is meant to be relaxing. Concentration in Buddhism is often associated not with striving and pushing, but with relaxing and letting go. And so the effort is balanced with letting go, with relaxation. And in fact, what I've seen in meditation practice is that, at the beginning of a meditation session, there might be required a certain amount of willpower. Here, if you want Pali words, willpower here takes the form of vitakka and vichara, applying oneself to the meditation object and sustaining one's attention there. It takes a certain kind of willpower to stay focused, and that might take a certain amount of glucose to do that. And it might be, if that's all you did, it might be tiring after a while. But as the concentration kicks in, or it gets more full, as concentration gets strengthened and balances the willpower, at some point the willpower becomes less and less willful, less and less effort is applied, until at some point it's no longer needed. Or it's needed a little bit, but it's there together with being deep, being relaxed. And rather than being draining, it's actually, we can be energized from it. And this is something I think in the book that I read, they don't seem to appreciate. They seem to only appreciate that willpower takes effort and you need to replenish it by eating more or resting. But in fact, certain kind of approach of using willpower together with relaxation can make it sustainable for a long time. And then, I hope I'm not talking too much of these ideas. Are you still following? Okay. Listening also requires willpower. And I don't know how your glucose levels are. And it's enough now. Some people say that Sunday morning sermons should not be longer than 20 minutes. But the Buddhists do longer because you're relaxed. So I think one of the strongest lists, more qualifies as the closer to what in English we say is willpower, is something called the four roads to power, the four roads to success, the four factors of success, the four factors of power. And this is a very interesting list of four things. And these also can be seen from a different angle, four different aspects of what in the West we would call willpower. And these are said to be needed for, in Thailand to this day, for any endeavor you're engaged in, you want to be successful in doing, you want to have all four involved. These are all four factors for success. But for the Buddha, he was talking about it mostly from the point of view success or in doing as the Buddhist practice. So the first is you need to have strong desire. So some people simplistically hear simplistic teachings on what the Buddha had to teach, where it says desires are the problem. We're not supposed to have desires. Let go of your desires, and then you can be free and happy. That's too simplistic. The Buddha didn't say that. A certain kind of desire gets us in trouble, causes suffering. But there are desires that help us. And there are healthy desires to have. And those desires, it's really good to have them strong. To have really strong and powerful desires. And so if you want to have willpower, if you want to act, have strong self-regulation, self-control, it helps if you have strong desire. If you have that, think of desiring as like a muscle. It's good to have that muscle strong so that you can choose wisely which desires to act on and follow through on. If you don't have that strong sense of desire, strength around being able to choose your desires and act on them, there's a class of desires that human beings have that if you're lazy, you can have a lot of energy to do these desires. Sexual desires, you know, can be really powerful. And the easy, relaxed thing to do is to give in to them. And you can be powerfully, you know, a lot of energy can go into that and get into a lot of trouble. I remember when I was young, you know, I mean, it's, you know, I could have powered California. you know, the energy that I had, you know, and the things I, you know, and the amount of energy I put in the pursuit of sex, you know, unsuccessfully usually, it was quite something, you know, as a teenager. And, you know, and you just kind of, just in a way, just kind of, you know, the easy thing is to act on these impulses. The impulse for addiction. It's the easy thing to do is to act on them sometimes because the healthy form of desire and ability to control and to act on it is not really developed. And so to develop this capacity is considered very important. So to appreciate the power, that cultivating a strong sense of capacity for desire, for practice, for freedom, for concentration, for kindness, for equanimity, for generosity. There's a lot of healthy desires to have, and to have that developed is considered one of these four roads to success, roads to power. The second is effort itself, virya, strength, exertion. There's a whole slew of words that are almost like synonyms in Buddhism that are words like effort and strength and exertion and perseverance. That are emphasized over and over again in the teachings of the Buddha. The Buddha, as far as I could tell, never used the word acceptance, which is often in Western Buddhism, is emphasized a lot. In fact, I think the secular mindfulness movement uses the word acceptance a lot, accepting mindfulness. I don't know if there's a Buddhist word that, you know, you could take the English word acceptance and find a Buddhist equivalent in the Buddha's language to translate that word. The closest, I think, would be probably equanimity. But I don't know if that's the same as acceptance. But what you do find is a lot of words like effort and energy. And in fact, some translators even will translate some of these words with the word striving, which is like willpower. A lot of the Vipassana teachers like myself kind of shy away from using the word striving. But there are people who like the word and will use it to translate the Buddha. So here again, the importance of developing our capacity to make effort, to apply ourselves. And it's not like an all or nothing thing. It's like a capacity that can grow over time. And it grows in small increments. I think it's much more, we can have much more confidence and much more encouragement to do this if we realize it's done in small steps. And so we apply ourselves a little bit in certain areas of our life. And so it goes. It develops over time. So meditation, you know, one of the things we're doing in meditation, every time you come back from the mind wandering and focus on your breath, you're applying energy and effort. And so you're strengthening that capacity for effort each time, a certain kind of effort. The fourth road to power, to success, is the state or the quality of your mind. That how you the quality that it's called citta, the quality of your mind, the state of your mind, is a very important thing to track and to monitor and to regulate if you want to be successful in things you do. So as I said, you know, if your glucose level is low, if you're tired and hungry, it's probably not the time to do certain things, and maybe it's more important to get rest and replenishment than it is to try to accomplish certain kinds of things, because maybe either you won't be able to do it very well, or you might end up making, you know, some mistakes. If you're making important decisions at work or important things at work, and it's hard and challenging and people are making mistakes and you're hungry and tired, then you might snap at them and get angry at them in the way you didn't if you weren't. And so that your general state of your being, your state of your mind, your consciousness, is something you can monitor and take some responsibility for and caretake for. If you're stressed out, that's not the time for certain kind of decisions or certain kind of things to do. If you're tired, if you're angry, if you have a lot of aversion going, that's what's happening. That's going to have a different kind of outcome. So are there ways of regulating, monitoring ourselves? I think it is. That's what mindfulness is for. And as you notice your state of your mind, you can make decisions about what you can do based on that. Maybe avoid certain things when you're in certain states of mind and choose certain things in other states of mind that you have. Or sometimes it's possible to, if the condition is just right, to help create inner conditions, to change the state of your mind, the state of your consciousness, so you have a state of consciousness which is more effective to accomplish certain things. So for example, if what you want to do is be compassionate, have more compassion in a situation, it really helps if you feel safe. It's hard to have compassion if you're not feeling safe. So can you cultivate a sense of safety? Maybe you can do a little bit if it occurs to you to do so. Maybe you have a little leeway to kind of relax, breathe deeply, and look around and say, well, no one's threatening me at this moment. And maybe I can relax and feel a little bit safer here right now. Or maybe a certain kind of reflections to help us feel more safe, to realize that the greatest danger is not what people can do to us, but what we can do to ourselves. And so if I can relax and monitor myself, then I will, I'll be safer. In fact, they found that self-control goes down when people get lost in external world. Like if you get lost in your desires and things out there and loose and not tracking yourself, then there can be very little self-control because you're not following, you're not watching your desires, your thoughts, reactions at all. So part of this monitoring ourselves is this third factor. I like to think that I'm trying all the time to be 50% of my attention to be on the world around me and people I'm with, and 50% of my attention is on myself. So I'm monitoring both, myself. So citta. So one of the roads of success is to monitor the state of our mind that we have, the mood, the quality of our mind, our quality of how we are. And the fourth road to success is, in Pali, it's vimamsa, which is usually translated into English as investigation. So to be discerning, to investigate, to be curious, to inquire, to look more deeply, to not kind of just take, you know, the obvious or your first impressions, or but to look more deeply, look both more deeply into the situation, look more deeply into yourself, because without and then to use it as a feedback system, look at the consequences of what you do, learn from that. So this maybe this last one can simply be called learning. Learn from what's going on, and if you learn, then you'll have more success. So your willpower will be more effective. Your ability to follow these roads of success will be more effective if you are a learner, if you're trying to learn as you do it. And it's quite impressive for me to meet a lot of people who don't seem to have a strong tendency to want to learn, especially when they want to teach me. I listen, you know, and it seems like, you know, it's not really open to learn or to be part of a cooperatively learning thing. So I don't know how you feel about the word willpower or self-control. Maybe you prefer not to live in a universe where those words are used. But I think that it's, you know, it's interesting to look at it and reflect a little bit, because something like willpower, something like control, self-control, is a very important part of Buddhist practice. And if you protesting that where's the spontaneity, where's the freedom, I would argue spontaneity is also very important. You cultivate a capacity for spontaneity and is important. But it really, I think what I've learned is it really works well when that ability of spontaneity is built on a really strong foundation of self-control, of willpower, self-monitoring, self-regulation. And then I think the spontaneity is quite beautiful. I'll end with one more story from the book. So there's a singer that I never heard of. There's so many things I haven't heard of. I missed the 1980s in terms of popular culture. The other day, last week, I was downtown in Redwood City, and they had a cover band. They were playing another, playing music of another band, and they were playing a band named Duran Duran. And I listened, Duran Duran, and there were so many people there, and the people older than me were singing the lyrics. And I said, "What is this?" So I went home and studied it to find out, and it would be kind of equivalent to someone in 1972 or something saying, "Who are the Beatles?"
Yeah.
I had no idea. I missed the 80s. Popularly, I was in the monastery, meditating, developing my self-control. And so there was a singer by the name of Amanda Palmers. Some of you know her. She apparently is more extreme than Lady Gaga and Madonna, and has a public persona of being kind of completely spontaneous and free and does whatever she wants to do and all that. But before she became a popular singer, she spent 6 years in Boston being a street artist kind of person who was one of these living statues who stands there and doesn't move, painted up in a certain kind of way, and just doesn't move unless someone drops money in her hat, and then they could take a picture of her, or she would actually give people a flower. Otherwise, if people would in Boston, would try to get her to react. And so if she had an itch, she couldn't scratch, right? Because she had to be still. If she had an urge to move, she couldn't, she couldn't move. And people would try to get her to move. They would do jokes to her, and they would do terrible things. They'd poke her and all kinds of difficult ways. And the art was to not move. And so for 6 years, she cultivated her willpower, her self-control, that she wouldn't give in. And when I read about her, she has this capacity for that. But her public persona doesn't show that. And maybe there's somehow a connection between the two. And when I read about her, she said she could do it 90 minutes at a time, and then she needed a break. And in the 5 years she did it, I think she said she did it, she only broke it twice or something. But the posture. But she said that... I forgot what I was going to say. So that was the last thing I'll say is that so when I read about her standing still for 90 minutes, I thought back to all my time in the monastery of sitting still in meditation. And that was a training. That was much more training that involved much, much more than a training to be mindful. Even though that was the rhetoric. So, I hope this is encouraging. And I hope that you do something with it. Develop your willpower in a good way. Thank you.